My name is Lindsay. I am here with Dr. Bill Blanchett, our internal medicine physician from Boulder, and Dr. Eric Dorninger, naturopath, also from Boulder, Colorado. We're talking about sleep apnea, the American sleeping sickness, sleep apnea, the silent killer. Welcome back, Dr. Blanchett.
Good afternoon, Lindsay. It's
fabulous having you here again. And Dr. Eric Dorninger, naturopath from Roots and Branches. Hi, Dr. D.
Good to see you.
I have Dr. D and Dr. B. Now, to get started, like I said, the title of tonight's show is The American Sleeping Sickness, Sleep Apnea, the Silent Killer. Dr. Dorninger, you sent out an email blast. I would like to tell our listeners what your first sentence was in this email blast. It is a hugely powerful sentence. One of the most insidious and vicious physiological experiences I have witnessed. Wow.
You bet.
Fill us in on insidious and vicious.
I have to say I'm sitting next to a great friend and mentor here in Dr. Bill Blanchett. He and I both agree that I don't think we do much of anything we learned in conventional or naturopathic medical school. You get the basics of how to learn in school, but then you get out into the real world and you start learning from your peers and your colleagues and your mentors what the heck is really going on in this world. As my patients know, Dr. Blanchett's my hero on arresting and preventing heart attack and stroke. And my first big experience of learning something with him was using the EBCT heart scan to really identify who's at risk of having heart attack and stroke. Later on, we got talking about, sleep apnea has a little something to do with heart disease too, doesn't it? I was always in the camp of sleep apnea is real. What I did not understand is how prevalent and dominating of a force it is in today's illnesses. It is everywhere. It is in everybody. And if you're not screening for it in primary care, just like the heart scan, we're doing a major disservice to our patients. And you're going to see sleep apnea in the psychiatrist. You're going to see it in the neurologist. You're going to see it in the rheumatologist. You're going to see it in the gyn. You're going to see it in obstetrics. It is rampant cause of multi-symptom illnesses.
I like the way you phrase it. I think that sleep apnea is real. I will run into people who say sleep apnea is just the disease du jour. It's just the thing that's hot, it's common, it's the sexy new diagnosis. Like it's not real. Like this is something that too many people have for it to actually be real. Let me tell you, sleep apnea is very, very real. The study that kind of drives that home is the one with heart disease, where they screened a group of older folks in their 80s for sleep apnea, found people with sleep apnea, found people without sleep apnea. Those with sleep apnea, they offered them CPAP treatment. 60% turned it down, 40% took the treatment. And they followed them prospectively. The group of 80-year-olds with sleep apnea who did not get the treatment had 3 times the cardiac mortality compared to people without sleep apnea. Those who had sleep apnea who took the treatment, all of that risk went away plus an additional 10%. They had 90% of the risk of people without sleep apnea because their apnea was treated. So in this population, sleep apnea is a huge risk for coronary death, and treating it gets rid of all of the risk. So there are a lot of other things about sleep apnea that come to light as being very real and very problematic. But here's a study that just shows it in black and white. 3x, 3 times risk of coronary death with untreated sleep apnea. All of that incremental risk goes away plus a little bit more by treating the sleep apnea. So yeah, we have a huge obligation to find and fix sleep apnea. It's not hard to find, it's not hard to fix, and it makes a monumental difference in both a person's quality of life as well as their quantity of life.
Do you think we're just becoming more aware of it, which is why it seems that it's like you said, it's almost like it's the disease du jour?
I think that's a big part of it. Back when I was in medical school, to diagnose sleep apnea was really difficult and to treat it was nearly impossible. And so the only people who even considered sleep apnea and were the so-called Pickwickians from Dickens' Pickwick Papers. People who were obese, had edema, were falling asleep on the desk all the time. And so those were people who said, oh, that guy has sleep apnea. Look at the edema in his legs. Look how big he is. Well, that's great if you want to find the top 2% of sleep apnea. If you want to find everybody else with sleep apnea, we now have ways to screen for it that's really, really easy, really, really inexpensive, and very, very effective in finding the disease.
You know what I'd like to add to that is I remember watching the movie Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead, where the Aussie fella does the juice fast and loses 200 pounds and he meets an American truck driver. And when you see the video of him sleeping, it's And you think that that's what an apneic has to look like. And these Dickens folks you're talking about, they're apneic during the day. They're so bad. Yeah. We were talking at your heart talk the other day. You shared 1/3 of all apneics are thin.
That's right. Basically, we think of sleep apnea as being someone who's overweight and has no neck. But 1/3 of people with sleep apnea have no phenotypic expressions that would make you think they should have sleep apnea.
And ironically, I was brushing up for today's talk, and I read that in Asians, actually thin people have a higher level of sleep apnea than obese Asians, and they believe it's because of the fascial structure of Asian populations. So sometimes it even goes as far as thin people are having a little bit more apnea than the heavier set folks.
Is it strictly a man's disease?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Females don't snore. You know that.
I'm well aware of that.
None of us do, ever.
Well aware of that. Apnea is equally distributed between men and women. And in fact, I saw a patient today in whom we had started her on treatment for sleep apnea, and she came in. She was the most satisfied patient I've ever had. She said, the quality of my sleep is so much better. I wake up, I feel so much better, feel so much more refreshed. She has lots of issues, and this didn't take care of all of her issues. But wow, did it make a difference to get quality of sleep that treating sleep apnea can bring.
What I would add to that is again, we want to go big picture for our patient population when we're educating them. And we talked about this a million different ways. There are two things every single cell in your body needs to produce ATP or energy, or what the Chinese call qi and the Ayurvedics call prana, and that's steady oxygen and fuel. And you can get fuel in the form of ketones, which is getting popularized in the epilepsy-reducing ketogenic diet, and glucose, which is blood sugar. You got to steady your blood sugar. This arrests every single cell in your body's ability to make energy through the night. So what tissue gets affected? Every tissue. And that's where we get these multi-system, multi-symptom experience. I'm waking tired. My brain is rusting and aging really fast. I'm having cardiac deficit. I feel like my muscles don't recover. There is a slightly higher prevalence in men, but you shared with me, and I was reviewing some of the peer-reviewed literature, that menopausal women also have a higher incidence of sleep apnea. So as they go into menopause, some of the conventional treatment approaches are thinking about bioidentical hormones, estrogen, progesterone, as somehow helping throat muscles maintain turgor and strength. We don't know, but what we do know is when women hit menopause, they go into a higher rate of apnea. Which is one of the reasons I say you have to go back and get a heart scan in 3 to 5 years. Because if you have a calcium score of 0 and you were not apneic in 2013, you went through menopause, maybe now you're apneic and driving calcified plaque in those arteries. So
that's fascinating what you said about the supplemental hormones for postmenopausal women. Maybe strengthening is what you meant, right?
Maybe.
All those throat muscles and everything that tend to... What do they do? Shut down? What happens?
They lose their tone. They sag. And so the soft palate sags down. The tongue kind of goes in the back of the throat. You're congesting that area where air needs to go. You breathe in. You create a negative pressure back there. And it slams shut like sucking water through a wet paper straw. And so if those tissues have better tone, palate stays up, the tongue stays forward, then you don't have as much apnea. It stays open better.
What happens is you stop breathing, like you were saying.
And one of the things I wanted you to clear up on the air for our listeners is the difference of a hypopnea versus an apnea.
Well, basically, a hypopnea versus apnea is a matter of degree. When you do a formal in-facility sleep study, we monitor the brain waves, we monitor the respiratory effort, we monitor airflow, we monitor the oxygen saturations. And so if you try to breathe, but air doesn't come through, but you don't really desaturate tremendously, but it does affect your brain waves a little bit. It's not apnea, but it's hypopnea. And it affects your sleep patterns. It affects the quality of sleep. And so when we're talking about what is apnea, when the oxygen level goes down and your tissues don't get oxygen, obviously that's a bad thing. I've shown patients their overnight oximetry where they desaturate down to the upper 70s, mid 70s.
Is that really low?
Well, then I'll put the clip on their finger and say, hold your breath until this gets down to the upper 70s. They can't do it. You're gasping for air before you get down to the mid-80s.
Wow.
And while they're sleeping, they spend a lot of time in the upper 70s. So this is really bad for your cells. But the other thing that happens is when you have an apnea episode or a hypopneic episode and your brainwave patterns shift from a deeper level of sleep to a more shallow level of sleep, you're not getting that deep restorative sleep you need to make your body work again. We always undervalue sleep. We think sleep is something we need to do when we've got nothing else to do. Turns out you can go twice as long without water as you can without sleep before you die. You can go 2 weeks without water, your system will shut down, you'll die a week without sleep. And with sleep apnea, you're just never getting that really deep restorative sleep. Getting that is important at so many levels.
And I would say one of the hallmarks, if you're just not waking rested and you did dedicate yourself to sleep, that's a problem. In my experience, we have to run a sleep study on you. You
Absolutely.
Put in the 8 hours, you wake up like a train wreck. You probably were desaturating or in hypopnea apnea.
Absolutely.
So this is a very, very serious condition to have.
At so many levels. Let me give you another example. A patient who had been diagnosed by a competent neurologist as having Alzheimer's disease. He is a priest, chaplain, had a consulting business, and now he has a diagnosis of Alzheimer's. So he comes to see me as a relatively new patient, and I said, well...
Beginning Alzheimer's patient?
With beginner Alzheimer's. Yeah. And I said, well, what about sleep apnea? I said, stop. He's a chaplain, so he knows about sleep apnea. He said, I will happily meet my maker before I put that damnable mask on my face. And I said, well, let's pull back a little bit. Give me the opportunity to find out what's going on, and then we'll talk about how to treat it. And so he agreed, and we did a sleep study. And I did a formal in-facility sleep study, which you don't need to do all the time, for sure. But in his case, I did. And happily, they did a split study. So the first half of the night, they found he had profound, horrible sleep apnea. The second half of the night, they put a CPAP mask on him and tried to find the right pressures. And he allowed that to happen. Woke up the next morning, even getting 3 hours of sleep with CPAP mask, feeling more refreshed, more energetic, more alert than he had woken up in years.
Right on.
And he said, okay, I'm reconsidering the CPAP. Well, he started wearing the CPAP routinely. He is now the poster child for wearing CPAP. And guess what? We're 8.5 years out now. His Alzheimer's is gone.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. He didn't have Alzheimer's. He had profound sleep deprivation from sleep apnea. The other thing is, before we did this, he was getting a stent every year or two because his coronary disease was progressing. And he was relatively young. He was in his late 50s. He thought he was old. He was relatively young. We treated sleep apnea and did a few other things. His coronary calcium score absolutely stabilized, stopped going up. He stopped having symptoms. He stopped getting stents. And today, he is still running a church. He's still doing a consulting business. He's still doing great.
Phenomenal.
And if we had not found the sleep apnea, he wouldn't be around anymore. He would have met his maker.
And just for our listeners who got blasted out that sleep apnea does drive Alzheimer's, that is true too. So we do have literature, and they do think it's through cerebrovascular problems. If you wind up plaquing your carotids, you're going to get to a point of hypoxia in the brain. That this is what happens.
We have to also remember that 40% of what gets clinically diagnosed as Alzheimer's is actually microvascular disease, mm-hmm. and you get these small infarcts in the brain. Mm. And so if you're not getting great blood flow, and the blood that's flowing doesn't have any oxygen in it because you're apneic, you can't be helping microvascular cerebral disease. And so, good stuff.
Dr. Blanchette and Dr. Eric Dorninger right here on the Tuesday Talk Show on KRFC Fort Collins 88.9 FM. My name is Lindsay, and we are talking about American sleeping sickness, or sleep apnea, the silent killer. If you have a question or you'd like to join in, I will open up the phone lines. The number to call in is 970-221-5065. For the first time ever, we have Dr. Bill Blanchette, internal medicine, and Dr. Eric Dorninger, naturopathic medicine, sitting right here on the same phone line. And thank you, somebody just called in. Hi, you're live on air.
Hello, good.
You are live on air. Who are we talking with?
Hello?
Yes.
I can hear you on the radio. I can hear you.
We can hear you, Larry, so keep talking.
Okay. My question, I had been diagnosed with sleep apnea and used the mask and did a nice recovery for me. And then I thought I was well enough to go along without it, and it seems to have been the case. I wonder, well, two questions. One, is it possible to regenerate those muscles via the CPAP, that it's useful to then minimize the use of it? The first question.
Okay.
The second question is, I'm wondering if singing would help tone up those muscles in the back of the throat that would be associated with the sleep apnea problem.
Great. Larry, we're going to pass the first question on to Dr. Paul Schett, the second one on to Dr. Dorninger, and I'm going to take you off the air so you can hear the answers.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling in.
Okay, well, the first question, we have a gentleman who was diagnosed with sleep apnea, got a CPAP mask, it worked. He stayed on the CPAP mask for a while and then stopped it because it felt like the symptoms were still controlled. So does the CPAP mask fix the problem so that after you've been on for a while, you don't need it? And the answer is for a very short period of time. Mm. What happens is with sleep apnea, your brain gradually gets used to putting up with sleep apnea. You fix it, your brain is no longer used to putting up with sleep apnea. You stop it, and for a period of time, you'll have much less sleep apnea than you did before. You've kind of trained your breathing patterns, et cetera. That wears off. So if all you have working for you is I've been using CPAP for a year and you stop using it, in a fairly short time frame, your apnea will return and the problems associated with apnea will return. However, the second part of the question, I'm going to pass the talking stick over to my friend here. The second part of the question is, are there things you can do to treat sleep apnea other than CPAP, or are there exercises you can do to maybe reduce the sleep apnea? And Eric, why don't you hit that one?
Yeah, and I think we really love teaming up on the subject because since working with Dr. Blanchett and deeper understanding of sleep apnea, I am so pro CPAP, and the masks have only gotten better. Some of the masks these days, they look like Porsches. They're totally hip and slick. It's not the old Darth Vader days anymore.
Right.
It's really come a long way. And one of the things I brought to Bill a while ago was this British Medical Journal study on sleep apnea and the didgeridoo. Patients know I have a didgeridoo next to my desk and I pipe into that thing. And what the study showed, and this was a pilot trial in Zurich in Switzerland, was they could actually heal sleep apnea by playing didgeridoo 15 to 20 minutes a day.
Let's tell everybody what didgeridoo is, because the first time you laid this on me,
right.
I didn't know what it was.
We're up from Boulder, where these elder hippies like to spend their retirement playing didgeridoo on the Pearl Street Mall. And for those of you who don't know, that's the Aboriginal instrument that's a hollowed log, basically. We have our patients just get a $35 didge online that's a plastic PVC, and it doesn't sound as nice as a old school hollowed log, but it sounds nice and it gets the job done. And you have to learn circular breathing.
Right.
And one of my, you could think of Dizzy Gillespie holding a note on the trumpet. There's Trombone Shorty out of New Orleans is a great musician if you want to YouTube, who does circular breathing. And he will hold a trumpet or a trombone note for minutes on end. And it's basically breathing in through the nose while you're breathing out your mouth and holding the tone. And it does profound improvement of the musculature for obstructive sleep apnea. And I'd love Dr. Blanchett to delineate central versus obstructive for our listeners, but we have had, and it's just like the gosh darn CPAP machine, when patients comply with playing the didgeridoo, it will arrest obstructive sleep apnea, but it's literally 15 to 20 minutes a day with the same exact experience as the CPAP. When they stop, when they go on a two-week vacation, they will revert back to sleep apnea. So we have one gentleman who plays this long, about a meter and a half long digit at home, but he has an 18-inch traveler that he puts into his suitcase.
A mini dig.
A mini dig. That's exactly what it's called. And then I have another patient who has his mini dig in his car, and every traffic light, he plays the mini dig.
Love it.
And these guys are getting more buff. They're looking great. The one that I shared with you, the most regular dig player that we have in our practice had a 7% decrease in his calcium coronary score just playing didgeridoo. Everything else we did, fish oil, methylated bees, et cetera, vitamin D, was all in place. And he finally, after a year and a half of nagging, you need to do the CPAP or you need to do the dig, And ideally, I like to see people on a CPAP and then transition to the DIG to see if they're really going to stick with it. But he didn't want to. Something about it not being sexy got in his head. And I said, what's not sexy is the testosterone drop you get from sleep apnea, by the way.
Well, that would be worth repeating to those guys out there who don't want to wear the CPAP.
And the ED, by the way. But he actually stuck with it. Not only did his adult depression go away, his adult onset attention deficit disorder, but he actually is pursuing his financial dreams, has the job he wants, and this guy looks fantastic. I couldn't be more inspired, and he does it literally. I saw his wife today in our waiting room, and I said, I'm going to be on the air talking about your hubby tonight. And she said he's 6 days a week minimum. And once in a while, he'll slip down to 5 days, but he never plays less than 15, 20 minutes a day.
And that's all you have to do is 15, 20 minutes
that's
a day,
it.
What, 5 times a week?
5, 6, 7 times a week. Now, in the beginning, I would say 7 days a week, you're trying to heal. And in the clinical trials, it was 3 to 6 months where they were evaluating it. But yes, the didgeridoo can heal obstructive sleep apnea. But as soon as you drop it, you're right back where you started.
So I have a question. I get that you start out on the CPAP and the person would like to cure themselves of sleep apnea. So then they take what you say, they go buy their own DIG.
Yes.
And they start playing it.
Yes.
Then they take the CPAP mask off. How do you know? You're asleep. How do you know if you've played enough DIG to stop your app?
Well, there's actually two good ways.
Okay.
One way is to ask the person who's sleeping on the other half of the bed with you, did I start snoring again? And the answer is yes, it's not working.
Okay.
But, you know, the nice thing is we have very simple screening tools to see how well is your oxygen holding at night, or are you having, you know, a sawtooth pattern with your oxygenation. And if your oxygen's nice and smooth and stable and above 90%, you're not going to have significant sleep apnea. And so I would encourage people who don't want to use a CPAP to do something like the didgeridoo, but validate.
Yes.
Validate that it's working.
Yes.
Because you may think you're doing the didgeridoo right, but this circular breathing thing it's a learning curve. It's not intuitive. It's not easy to do. And so there are options, but validate them.
Well, let's talk about how do you validate them?
Getting back to his question, though,
okay,
about singing. Will singing treat sleep apnea? And I think that, you know, singing like Conway Twitty or Willie Nelson ain't going to do much for sleep apnea. If you sing like Enrico Caruso, maybe you will. Maybe you will. But once again, validate it. Do an overnight oximetry and validate that this is working.
I always wanted to look at the three tenors and do a snap study on them and see if that obesity, did they still not have sleep apnea? Or trombone players or trumpet players in orchestra. It'd be very fascinating to look at that.
What about those long Swiss horns that we see on the
Ricola? Maybe that's why.
Things?
Maybe, and I would tell our listeners, and most of my patients know this, but Google sleep apnea, didgeridoo, Google will autocorrect, and British Medical Journal. And there's a phenomenal 3 to 4 minute YouTube clip on that study. And he actually does a scope to look at the throat muscles and the voice box while the patient's playing the didge.
Nice.
And the guy is, it's a Swiss guy, and he's like, yes, after the didgeridoo, I had zero hypopneas, apneas. And it's just a great little clip of the study. And again, you got to stick with it. But one of the reasons Bill and I get along so well is because we believe in retest. Retest. I mean, if you see a flagrantly elevated CRP, was it an infection or is there cancer? You know, you need to apply a treatment and then reevaluate that treatment. Don't abandon that patient. Don't abandon what you're working on. And I would say that regardless of what method you do, retesting is only getting better, including patients who have CPAPs now get automated chips that can just get downloaded to the sleep clinic and they can see how they're doing.
Well, that's slick.
Yeah, actually, the patient I saw this morning, she knew from looking at her machine that she was having less than one apneic hypopneic episode per hour, less than one.
That's awesome.
And you go from having, you know,
several.
Well, yeah, if you have less than five, you don't have significant apnea. But if you have 17, 20, 40, I've seen as much as 65 episodes per hour. Mm. The person does not go 60 seconds without having their sleep interrupted by an apneic episode.
Well, that's almost close to death.
Well,
it sounds like.
You can actually acutely die from sleep apnea. That happens. And I've had I've had two patients in the past who I'm certain died from sleep apnea. Another patient fairly recently who came very close to dying from sleep apnea.
Wow.
And in his case, we knew he had sleep apnea. I had set him up with a CPAP mask, and he didn't like it. So we set him up with a mandibular advancement device.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mandibular advancement device, or MAD, is an alternative for treating sleep apnea, where it just kind of opens up the back of your jaw, brings your jaw forward, and so the tongue is pulled away from the back of the palate. And for a certain percentage of people, 70-75% of people, it will do an adequate job of treating sleep apnea. So I have a number of patients who just can't do the mask, who actually have their symptoms well controlled with a mandibular advancement device. But once again, the fact that it works now doesn't mean it's going to work 5 years from now.
Exactly.
And I can be personal testimony to that because I have sleep apnea, and for the first decade I treated it with a mandibular advancement device, and it worked great initially, and then over time it kind of lost its punch. And I've recently switched over to a CPAP mask, and I had kind of the same experience as my patient did this morning. It's like, wow, this is really neat. It's great to wake up with my brain working for me.
Yeah.
I can remember names and remember, you know.
Dr. Blanchett's brain on CPAP is pretty unreal.
It was amazing off CPAP.
Yeah, he's hanging in there now. It's just outrageous.
Exactly.
But I think that's a good point you're bringing up, that in the research, the dental devices don't work for a lot of the people who do them. And the dentists often don't retest. So the patient's
that's
out there, it's
not
almost
in
like getting a stint and thinking now you're free of heart attack risk.
Exactly. Like
you
that.
Know, and the other one is, if you don't mind speaking to the UPPP, the uvula palatal pharyngeal plasty, and then also there's the hypoglossal stimulator, which is pretty trippy.
Well, yeah, to cut is to cure. In medicine, we feel that if we can cut something out, we can cure you. All this medical stuff is just keeps you around. To cut is to cure. With sleep apnea, it's really not.
Mm.
You know, they have surgeries to try to treat sleep apnea. And one is to trim the edge of the soft palate and clip off the uvula.
That's that little thing that
the little thing
down.
That dangles in the back of the throat. And then you just trim the edge of the soft palate so it hangs a little bit higher. Another is actually to put a bolt in the muscle in the tongue and pull the tongue forward. So
that doesn't even sound nice.
And here's the problem. If you do this trimming of the palate, it does a great job of getting rid of snoring, but does a terrible job of treating apnea.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked about two patients I had who have died from apnea.
Yes.
One of them, this was many years ago, he had apnea. He saw a ENT about his apnea. They did the surgery. They trimmed his soft palate. And he went out and lost 40 pounds. And his apnea disappeared. He was really proud. Probably the losing 40 pounds had more to do with it than trimming the soft palate. But his snoring went away. His apnea went away. He was doing great. Well, he moves down to Florida for a few years, moves back to Colorado, moves up to Estes Park. In the meantime, he's gained back his 40 pounds. But because he no longer has a uvula or much of that soft palate, he still doesn't snore.
So he thinks he's fine.
And the reason I'm certain he died from sleep apnea is he comes in having had a cardiorespiratory arrest. But talking to his wife, she said, well, yesterday morning when I woke up, he was making this real grunting noise while he was asleep. So I woke him up, and he was really groggy, really hard to wake him up. Mm. Took 10 minutes for his get his head screwed back on. Then this morning, he was doing the same thing, but I had to pee really badly. So I ran to the bathroom to pee and came back. He wasn't breathing at all.
Oh. Wow.
And so that has to be a sleep apneic death.
Right, which doesn't have to happen at night, apparently.
Yeah.
I was just thinking how deprived that heart was of oxygen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so I am a huge non-fan of surgery for sleep apnea.
Mm-hmm.
About the only surgery that predictably works for obstructive sleep apnea is a tracheostomy.
Mm.
And anyone who thinks that a tracheostomy is better than a CPAP mask is wrong.
Yeah, talk to us later. Dr. Dorninger, I didn't read, everyone, the second sentence in your email, which followed the insidious and vicious physiological experience that you have witnessed. You stated that sleep apnea can steal your brain, drive cancer, lead to erectile dysfunction, interstitial cystitis, autoimmunities, and premature death. This is a wicked, wicked, wicked condition.
I think we just got the guy's attention.
I hope so.
With the ED.
Yeah,
there.
I didn't do the ED. I spelled it out for him so they wouldn't miss it.
Well, one of the things I thought about Bill and I could do at one point tonight if we were just free on time was just play a game of let's mention every disease that sleep apnea could be a part of.
Yeah. I'm just going to say we left off adult diabetes there.
Adult diabetes?
Yes.
Yeah. There's one thing before we get into all those diseases, because Dr. Blanchet's story, a man died because he wasn't followed up on sleep apnea. If he got a uvula removed and he had been followed with testing, we would have realized this is absolutely not working. And I wanted to have Dr. Blanchet speak a little bit to two things. And the first is, if you're not snoring, that does not mean you don't have apnea. We have plenty of patients who do not snore and are flagrantly apneic. And the second is our great conversation on the CPAP and attitude. I've realized that someone who takes on really complex cases and sometimes passes those off to Dr. Blanchet.
And vice versa.
And vice versa, yes.
I mean, we really are getting a feel of how intense the human condition can go in regards to physiological misery. That attitude for all our patients, if they come in with an attitude of positivity and earnestness, and I want this to work, and I understand it doesn't always roll out the way we want it to, you get somewhere. And we had this great conversation in regards to CPAP. I'd love you to share that.
Two examples. I have a first cousin. She's in her 80s, and she has fairly mild sleep apnea. But she was also having some memory issues, and we thought, this is something we can fix and maybe make her memory better. So we get her hooked up with a CPAP machine. And she is saying, you're kidding. This is a joke, right? This is from Monty Python. You're not expecting me to actually wear this mask. And it's like, just give it a try. Let's see what happens. She never touched. She never put it on her face. It just never worked. She had it for a few weeks. We sent it back to the company. Useless. But she had a terrible attitude towards CPAP. Another friend who's a songwriter, I was talking to him on the phone. He was telling me that he's recently been started on CPAP and said, you know, Bill, it's like falling asleep kissing a beautiful woman. It's like, yeah, that's the attitude.
Is that how you're selling CPAP now?
Any way I can do it. Now, this is someone who was married to a very beautiful woman, but he preferred fall asleep kissing a CPAP mask. And, you know, it's one of those things. Finding and fixing sleep apnea is so important that every once in a while, I just have to grab a patient by the lapel and say, look, your kids need you around. Your family needs you around. You're still having fun. Why do you want to throw it away by not treating this disease that creates all these other problems that you also are dealing with?
And I would say if you're apneic, a lot of times you're not having fun. And that's where the compassion comes in, where the attitude might not be there. Dopamine levels are highly affected by hypoxia. Dopamine's ambition and drive, feelings of self-worth, feelings of hopefulness, part of your libido, ability to finish tasks. So I wonder if partially some of the people with flagrant sleep apnea are so dopamine deprived, they don't have the gumption to take on the project.
Erica talked about low testosterone levels and low libido
and
decreased sexual function associated with sleep apnea. And the connection there is very, very direct. Because first off, if you have sleep apnea, you're tired. And if you're tired, the libido is going to be one of the first things to go. But the most common cause of low testosterone is a condition called hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, which is to say your brain stops producing the hormones that trigger your testicles or ovaries to produce sex hormones because the system is stressed. And that's physiologic. When there's no water, there's no food, you're stressed, let's stop having children until we're no longer stressed. It works a function. But in the circumstance of I'm stressed because I have sleep apnea, and so do we treat the sleep apnea or do we put you on some Prozac for your depression so you have more energy, put you on a little bit of Cialis for your erectile dysfunction, give you some testosterone injections for your low testosterone, or do we treat your sleep apnea and maybe physiologically all those correct themselves?
You know, I can answer that question and I think everybody else can. You just said what is happening now in the medical field. They go immediately to a prescription. I think you mentioned it again in your email, which you could tell was very impacting on me. Are people being routinely tested for sleep apnea? Is that one of the things on the standard checklist?
Well, this is something I'd actually like to kick over to Bill again, because I'm getting frustrated with this. At the end of the day, you feel like a fool if you missed the apnea wasn't corrected. And that's what people aren't doing enough. And I think you bring up a good point that some prescriptions in particular are central nervous system depressants. And you can really be on meds that also drive apnea.
Very, very right. Common. The person with sleep apnea presents with insomnia. Just, I can't stay asleep. And so the doctor puts them on drugs to make them sleep. And those drugs can substantially worsen the sleep apnea. And so they're sleeping more. They're unconscious more. They're probably more hypoxic than they were before. And they're less healthy than they were before, but at least they're getting 7 hours of unconsciousness. I don't consider that to be a win. I think fixing the sleep apnea, if that's the problem, rather than increase the number of hours they're unconscious at night, is where the win is found.
And you're the one who taught me that Lunesta and Ambien are basically hypnotics.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going into restorative sleep.
There are very few drugs that, quote unquote, improve your sleep, actually improve your sleep.
Yeah.
They'll increase the volume of time you're unconscious, but they will not improve the sleep. Sleep is a very active endeavor where the sleep center of the brain is much more active when you're asleep than when you're awake.
Yeah, it's got a lot of jobs to do.
It's got stuff to do. And when you use a central nervous system suppressant to improve your sleep, you're suppressing your awake center and you're suppressing your sleep center and you're unconscious, which is not a win.
So do you think that patients who go to their primary care physician and says, you know, I can't sleep at all, maybe they themselves should start becoming a little bit more proactive and say, you know what, I'd really like a sleeping prescription, but maybe before we do that, what do you think about checking me for apnea?
I have one big comment to make secondary to you don't wake refreshed. The other thing is, if you fall asleep and you wake up, that is a blood sugar problem or an oxygen problem. In my experience, 9 out of 10 times, the brain is panicking and causing you to wake. And you think it has to do something with urinating. And then if we measured your urine volumes, a lot of times they're not going to be substantial. Or you think, now I'm worrying about my son at college, and is he failing out, or is he doing X, Y, and Z? It wasn't your worry that woke you up. Primal needs from the brain. The brain needs steady fuel. It needs steady oxygen. When it doesn't get those, it's going to panic and wake you up.
So you're talking about diabetes and sleep apnea.
We're talking about diabetes,
oxygen,
sleep apnea,
yeah.
Eating a bowl of Barbara's Organic Gorilla Munch before bed and going into a hypoglycemic coma. I mean,
an organic hypoglycemic coma.
That's right. You're getting your organic diabetes.
You did mention some of the things really important worth talking about. Is the number of patients I see with sleep apnea whose presenting complaint is, I get up too many times at night to urinate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't sleep well because I have to get up and pee. I think there's something wrong with my kidneys, something wrong with my bladder, something wrong with my prostate. And what happens is, if you have sleep apnea and you're suffocating and you wake up in that state, it's very common to have an urge to urinate, even though you may not have a huge quantity of urine. And so it's really, really commonly a symptom of sleep apnea. But here's the other remarkable phenomenon. If you have significant sleep apnea and you're becoming hypoxic, that actually acutely changes the pressures in your lungs, stresses your right ventricle, stresses your right atrium, and we release a hormone called brain natriuretic peptide. Brain natriuretic peptide makes you pee more. So you may actually have a larger volume of urine because of your sleep apnea releasing this brain natriuretic peptide. And so if you treat the sleep apnea, you stop releasing this brain natriuretic peptide, you don't get this artificial diuresis that you don't need. You stay better hydrated during the daytime, and you don't get up at night to urinate. It's truly remarkable how that works. And so if you're going to see your doctor because you're waking up at night to urinate, and your doctor doesn't suggest ruling out sleep apnea, your doctor needs to take a CME.
Or like we say all the time, maybe you, the patient, needs to get a little proactive and tactfully ask, before we run out of time, what's like step one?
We have the peer-reviewed literature on it, but your perspective on a home SNAP sleep study as a screening. And this is a weird experience we've had where the sleep doctor thinks I'm stealing their business by doing a home sleep study. And in reality, I've done the screening to get them to
more
the sleep doctor.
Right.
You know, and in the end, all I care about is my patient's quality of life and removing them from the healthcare system. But they might need the sleep doctor to restoration of health.
You're the wide mouth of the funnel, Dr. Dorninger.
So basically,
so what do you do?
I love the home sleep study because with a home sleep study, it has actually several advantages over a facility-based sleep study. Number one, you're sleeping in your own own bed in your own home in normal circumstances. Secondly, you have 3 nights or 4 nights to try to get good results. And so you can get used to having this strap around your chest. Mm-hmm. You can get used to having this nasal cannula. Whereas if you go to the sleep lab, all of this stuff is new. You're in a different bed, in a different environment. You get the sense that somebody is looking at you because somebody's looking at you. It's hard to get a physiologic night's sleep. I can give you a great example of a patient I have who lives in Estes Park. We did a SNAP, and it was horrible. But in order to get what we needed, we actually had to do an in-facility sleep study. So he comes from Estes Park down to Boulder, does an in-facility sleep study, and it is normal.
Mm. Altitude.
It's completely normal. And so we lost the effect of altitude. And so in Estes Park, he has significant sleep apnea. In Boulder, he has no sleep apnea. And high altitude is a huge exacerbating factor for both obstructive and central sleep apnea. I just want to clarify the difference between obstructive sleep apnea and central. Mm-hmm. Obstructive sleep apnea is when the tongue and the palate and the back of the throat get together and shut off your airflow. Central sleep apnea.
Thank you, Dr. Dorninger.
Central sleep apnea is when your brain stops recognizing that you have to keep breathing. Mm. And so the brain doesn't send the message to the diaphragms to breathe because it's gotten too comfortable with low oxygen levels. So in most cases, central sleep apnea is a secondary effect of long-term obstructive sleep apnea. It can also be an effect of drugs. It can also be an effect of cerebral vascular disease. If you have a stroke, you can get central sleep apnea. In my experience, the most common cause of central sleep apnea is long-standing, untreated, obstructive sleep apnea.
Question on me, I feel a little shortchanged now because you didn't put the 3-day strap around thing. You just gave me a little sensor on my finger and a computer.
As a screen for sleep apnea, you have 3 options. Just the overnight oxygen test, which you had.
I had.
The home sleep study, of which a SNAP is one form, which I particularly like, the SNAP
brand.
Sleep test.
That's the 3-day strap around your chest.
3 days, do it to your own bed.
Okay.
Or a facility-based sleep study, go to the lab and do it there. They did a study in Australia that showed that as a screen for sleep apnea, these 3 tests were non-inferior to each other. And so if I want to screen you for sleep apnea, I do just the home oxygen monitor, and you do really well on that. I say you don't have sleep apnea. That's a very accurate statement. With the home oxygen test, if it's abnormal, I don't have as good a sense as to how much sleep apnea you have and how aggressive we need to treat it. With the SNAP test, I get a very good sense about that. With the in-facility study, I get the best metrics on that, but it's done in a strange place in a strange bed where you're wired in all different directions. I'm not sure I can completely believe that as well as I can believe the one you do yourself at home.
Mm-hmm. Famous last words, Dr. Dorninger.
I would say it's going to take a while if you get diagnosed with apnea to get that CPAP right, to get to the sleep doctor, and you're still going to have to fiddle. Might as well get a didgeridoo in the meantime and just come at it, blow at it from every angle possible.
Dr. Blanchette, your famous last words.
Famous last words. Sleep apnea is important. Sleep apnea is a big underdiagnosed problem in this country. If you get the CPAP and you hate your CPAP, it's probably because the mask is not fitting right or the settings aren't right. And you need to work with your doctor, work with the people who provide the equipment until it is right. And as you pointed out, patients have to be their own advocates. The squeaky wheel gets the grease. The person who gets a system that's not working, who just is at home, tries to put up with it and gives up on it, their problem never gets fixed. If it's not working, make people aware that it's not working until you get the mask that works, get the pressures that work, get the systems that work. And when it's working, it is so easy to tolerate. It really is.
So ladies and gentlemen out there, if your partner be your partner be a he or your partner be a she. If somebody is snoring, pay attention to that. Should they get checked anyway?
If they have other symptoms like wake up feeling tired, have no energy, have depression, it's a really good thing to check.
Yep.
Even if they're not snoring. But the spousal observation of the person stopping breathing is the most accurate test for sleep apnea. If your spouse says you're snoring loudly and occasionally you stop breathing, you have sleep apnea, stop denying it, get it taken care of.
And weight loss resistance. We've seen people
Perfect.
Eat better than I do. They exercise more than I do, and they are not losing weight, and the apnea is crushing their metabolism.
Dr. Bill Blanchette, internal medicine physician, and Dr. Eric Dorninger, naturopathic physician from Boulder. Very quickly, Dr. D, what's your website?
drdorninger.com.
And Dr. Blanchette, your website?
boulderscan.com.
Have a wonderful, happy, healthy, non-snoring week ahead. Dr. Blanchette and Dr. Dorninger, thank you so much.